It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, online star Issa Rae talks about her hit YouTube series and the difficulties of life as an introvert.
First, a three-member panel has unanimously upheld the firing of Christopher Manny, the former Milwaukee police officer responsible for the fatal shooting of 31-year-old Dontre Hamilton last year.
This comes after 5 days of appeal hearings in which Manny asked for reinstatement. He had been fired for violating Milwaukee Police Department rules during his encounter with Hamilton.
Joining us now to talk more about that decision is Chuck Kornbach, WPR's reporter in Milwaukee, who's been covering that story. Chuck, welcome back.
Good afternoon.
A panel of three Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission members reached their decision last night after days of testimony. What were they looking at there?
Well, they were looking at two things. First was a phase one, they called it, which is whether Officer Manny, former Officer Manny, violated two department rules in his approach and handling of Dontre Hamilton in the Milwaukee Park last April 30th. The two rules mainly regarded rules about needing to have a reasonable suspicion of the individual having a weapon or reasonable suspicion of being harmed by the person who was approaching, and in other words, getting that close and starting to frisk Hamilton. The police department said Manny did not have a reasonable suspicion of being harmed. The second was whether Manny followed some other procedures, including, you know, adequately calling for backup before he started the initiating with Mr. Hamilton.
And that was phase.
So that was phase one.
And yep. What did people have to say on both sides when they considered those questions?
Well, there was a lot of looking at department training, police training in general, as to what is a reasonable threat, what is a not reasonable threat, why Manny thought that he should initiate things, how he approached Dontre Hamilton, and then all of a sudden Mr. Hamilton sort of surprised him by opening his eyes and what's being called giving Manny a thousand-yard stare, making Manny more fearful all of a sudden. So things started to escalate, and then the baton was involved, and Hamilton took the baton from Manny, and then eventually Manny shot Hamilton. But that, the shooting wasn't in dispute. That was all covered last fall in the review by the district attorney, who decided not to press charges against Manny. What was at stake were these two rules leading up to contact with Hamilton.
And as far as whether Officer Manny should have called for backup before he approached Hamilton, what did the commission find?
Well, in both cases, they ruled in favor of the department. The department has suggested repeatedly that Manny should not have gone up and done this initiation with Hamilton on his own, or been more careful about it, and certainly should not have started frisking Hamilton in the way he did. So, and Manny's defense has been, listen, I can't predict the future. I had to react as things were happening quickly. I couldn't see exactly what Hamilton had in his pocket. There was a lot of attention paid to a bulge in the right front pants pocket of Hamilton. It wound up, I believe, being a cell phone charger. But for a while, Manny thought it was a weapon, and might be a weapon anyway, and was beginning to frisk Hamilton when things got much more violent.
And that was phase one. What happened during phase two of this?
Well, phase one ended around 7 o'clock last night when the commissioners came back to give their verdict, if you will. Phase two then quickly launched and only took a couple of hours. It was basically Chief Flynn first taking the stand, explaining it was phase two was regarding punishment. Was it the right kind of punishment? And in phase two, Flynn took the stand first, describing that he thought the amount of harm that happened in the incident, in other words, the death of Dontre Hamilton, was a key factor. Flynn also talked about not being able to bring Manny back on the police force. What would he do with him? What sort of job would Manny have that would be guaranteed public safety for officer safety? So that was what Flynn argued. Quickly then, the defense brought Christopher Manny to the stand and talked about his military record before he was a police officer, talked about his highly awarded career as a Milwaukee officer. And Manny then addressed the commission and said, listen, I have been a cop. I've always been a cop. Please let me stay a cop. It wasn't clear whether Manny would immediately come back to the force because he's also applied for disability pay. But he at least expressed interest in continuing as a police officer. But the commission deliberated a shorter amount of time, came back, and again, the answer was to support what the police department had ruled, that the firing was justified.
Now, this was, as you said, a unanimous decision on all parts here. What do you think was at stake in these findings yesterday?
Well, obviously the career, at least as a Milwaukee officer, of Christopher Manny, but as we heard from last night from Dontre Hamilton's family and what we've heard for weeks and months now, is that this was about a community issue. It's about respect between the police department and especially the African-American community. Dontre Hamilton was African-American. After the ruling, the Hamilton family was happier with things, a measure of relief, of course, but saying that, listen, we want to continue to improve police community relations. We want to continue for African-Americans to be treated respectfully here. And that's really what will be the story in the next few weeks and months, at least one of the stories, is whether that comes into place.
Right, and it sounds like Hamilton's family is likely to pursue additional action against Manny. Do we know how soon and in what form?
Well, certainly I think their case got a bit of a boost yesterday with the ruling that Manny should have been fired. It may take the civil lawsuit action. Exactly when, I don't know. They are also waiting, I think, for some federal government input on whether there's ongoing problems in the Milwaukee Police Department racially, and also whether the Hamilton shooting was justified under federal civil rights law. So I think there's a number of things waiting to see. More immediately is that the police union is quite upset with the decision. They've issued a press release saying that this Manny firing was a travesty. The upholding of it was a travesty. The police association will talk to the media later today. They say it was a seemingly results-oriented decision. That there's concerns for continued safety for our community, and they're going to talk about a way forward for the police officers.
Is there any further appeal that Officer Manny could take at this point, or any action that the Milwaukee Police Association could take on his behalf?
Well, certainly that's one thing that may become more clear later today, is to whether Officer Manny's case is going to be appealed to a circuit court, which can review things. Also is the issue of Manny's application for duty disability, because he applied a couple of days before he was fired back in October. Yesterday's decision apparently does not harm that application, so it's possible that Manny could go on duty disability and get a pretty good chunk of pay. Or he will potentially apply to other departments. There have been Milwaukee police officers fired before and have found jobs in the suburbs or outstate or in another state. So hard to say, but those are some of the options ahead for Manny.
Chuck, do you have any indication how closely this recent decision was watched beyond the interested parties, beyond law enforcement and the Dontre Hamilton family?
Well, certainly as it came, the Hamilton killing, if you will, April 30th came before Ferguson, Missouri, and the Michael Brown case there. But it occasionally surfaced over the last 6 months of the year as there were protests in Milwaukee, the freeway protests leading up to the John Chisholm, the DA's decision not to file criminal charges against Manny. So it occasionally got to the national level. Jesse Jackson came in from Chicago to support the Hamilton family. And the New York Times and other national media have taken a look at this case sort of in the context of this ongoing headlines of officer-involved shootings of mainly African-American men. Of course, the case in Madison played into all that as well. So it's part of this ongoing closer examination and scrutiny of where we are in police-community relations.
Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Chuck Kornbuck, WPR's reporter in Milwaukee, who's been covering the Dontre Hamilton case.
For Joissa Rae Jope, the internet has been a fixation ever since her father's first subscription to AOL. While offline, she bounced from school to school.
Amid all the change, one thing stayed the same. She felt awkward. In the years since, her life story and love of the internet blossomed into the popular YouTube workplace comedy series called Awkward Black Girl.
She's currently developing a half-hour comedy for HBO called Insecure. She's also the author of the new book, Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl. Issa Rae, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
All right, so on one hand, you've got a hit YouTube series, this book now, HBO series, yet you're awkward, you're an introvert. How does an awkward introvert get out there and put herself in the public eye like that?
She tries hard not to. she avoids it at all costs, but, you know, with the job comes the necessity to have to be out in public, and, you know, I just have to treat it as such. It's a job that I go to, and then I get to be a recluse at home and just minimize my social interactions as much as possible.
I think of a lot of celebrities thriving on the energy of being out there in front of people, and then I think of introverts needing to retreat and, as you say, isolate themselves. Is that part of what it takes? You have to have that downtime to recharge?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I spend a lot of alone time. I spend a lot of time with my core friends and family, but I always need that recharge time. Like, I'm completely drained after a social event, and it is nothing personal. It's nothing against people in general. It's me. It's not them.
So growing up, what was at the heart of your sense of awkwardness?
You know, honestly, I was in a constant state of transition. My family moved around a lot. If it wasn't from country to country or state to state, it was from house to house. Like, we were never in any place longer than 2 years, and in any school at one point longer than 2 years, and I would constantly find that I had to reintroduce myself and, in a sense, reinvent myself or to make new friends, and that's just, you're in a constant state of discomfort at that point. And the real transition for me came from moving from Potomac to L.A. and when my blackness started to come into question, and that was like a huge blow in the face for me because I had never imagined that anybody could question whether or not I was black enough.
Yeah, so you write that it's difficult to come into your own when you're not just an awkward girl, but an awkward black girl. So what makes that harder? Why is that harder to fit in that that three-part role, awkward, black, and girl?
You know, already within mainstream media, there's this perception of blackness as it's pretty limited. You're either cool and suave and trendy, or you're loud and sassy and angry. And there are all these perceptions that I just felt like I didn't fit into either. And that's where my awkward blackness is concerned, not fitting into mainstream media's perception of blackness. And then just in the traditional sense of awkwardness in that I just felt socially uncomfortable in the way that all adolescents do, but I never really grew out of it. And it's just something that I had to learn to embrace after a while and really just be open about it. But it's something that I just consistently struggle with.
Yeah, you write about encounters, I think, with classmates. I think we're in the high school era here where people are like, talk about hip-hop artists, rap artists, and how they know more about them than you, and therefore they're blacker than you. And this is from white classmates.
Right. There just came a sort of standard of blackness that I had to achieve that was based off of the merit of those who weren't black. And that was based off of what they saw on television or in film. And it's just what they chose to define blackness as is something that I was supposed to, they imposed their definition of blackness on me. And I didn't subscribe to that definition or their notion of blackness, I guess.
So as an awkward white guy myself and an introvert, I feel like, okay, society gets it. There's a lot of room for a white guy to have a wide range of personality traits. And it seems like there's just a few boxes that people want to put you in based on these two outward markers, being black and being female.
Yeah, but I'm optimistic that because of the internet and because of even recent trends in television, I feel like that may change. I feel like there are more opportunities now for that to change. And it wasn't always the case. We just had a dearth of kind of black characters as soon as the millennium hit. And now maybe we're in a new age where there are more opportunities for more archetypes to surface.
So apart from your own online show, now HBO show, are there other TV shows, books, movies you'd point to that are starting to open more personality types, I guess, for black women in pop culture?
I would point to anything Shondaland, Thursday nights. I would point to Mara Brock-Akil, people like Ava DuVernay. There's just so many creators out there, and even online. And I tend to collaborate with other series creators that are presenting alternative representations. But there's just a whole slew of images that I'm excited about.
And you write, when we think of shows like Girls, The New Girl, a few others like that, you point out in an essay that was excerpted, actually, from the book, women of color don't come to mind. When girls are referred to in a show title, it's young white women, usually. How locked in are we there?
How locked in are we? I think that, honestly, there's a notion that only white people can be relatable, and that's what's always kind of bothered me. There's an assumption that if there are all black characters in a television show or in a film, then it's automatically relegated as a black show. And that's an assumption that I want to change, and I want to show that people of color can be relatable at the end of the day, and we are. We as human beings, we all go through the same things and the same feelings. And it just seems like common sense, but that's just not the case.
Well, I want to talk to you about Awkward Black Girl, the YouTube series. What did you set out to do when you started, and what was it like when it blew up on the internet?
I set out to create an alternative representation that I could relate to, and initially I wanted to make it an animated series. Awkward Black Girl was actually my third web series, and the prior to I tried to use as a gateway to television to say, hey, I'm going to develop these online and get an audience, and then I'm going to take this to television and show them that there's an audience. And I was constantly told that I didn't have one, when what I was seeing online was that I did, that I had an audience that appreciated my content as is in its raw, purest form. And so by the time I got to Awkward Black Girl, I said, I'm going to create this, and I'm not even going to try to take this to television. This is specifically for the internet. And I just found that the audience was ready for it. It was just good timing because of what we weren't seeing, and they really embraced the character in a way that I just did not expect at all.
Now, one issue that comes up in an early episode, I think it might have been the first episode of Awkward Black Girl, and you have a segment on it, you have a series of ABG, Awkward Black Girl Guides, is the hair issue, and people commenting on your hair and how it changes at one point, wanting to touch it. Can you talk about the state of affairs? This seems like an ongoing discussion, how people react to and relate to your hair.
Hair is just one of the touchy subjects, especially, just in the black community, there's a history of not appreciating our hair as is and being told that our hair isn't good enough and trying to change it. And that's something that I went through, growing up. I had to learn to appreciate and embrace my hair. And there's such a fascination with our texture in a way that can be offensive because people want to touch it. They want to treat it like, you are a pet in a way. Can I touch it? Can I see what happens? What happens when it gets wet? And, when people are treating your hair like a foreign object, you tend to have an instinct to want to hide it. And that very much happened to me until I finally just decided to cut it all off and just go bald. And it made me realize how trivial hair is at the end of the day. I've never felt so free as when I didn't have hair. And, now that it's growing out, I love it. I love what I can do with it. And I feel like there really is sort of a movement happening with black women and their natural hair. And it's a beautiful thing.
Now, since Awkward Black Girl, the web series, got big, are you hearing from a lot of other self-declared awkward black girls who are saying things like, wow, somebody gets it. This is my life, too?
Absolutely. People have told me they've come out of the awkward closet. They've been saying that they didn't know what they were, until they saw this series or even read the book, and they now realize they're awkward. And it's really validated me more than anything in that I'm not alone, that I don't have the soul thoughts that run through my head of, insecurity and discomfort. And it's created a community, and I love it.
Can you leave us with a little advice? I imagine there are a lot of young people out there feeling awkward for one reason or another. Your advice based on your story to someone who feels awkward and different from those around them.
I would say embrace it and tell people what you are up front. Don't try to hide it because it'll only get worse for you. Just accept who you are and accept your diagnosis and just move forward and work with what you have.
Issa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Issa Rae. She's creator of the YouTube comedy Awkward Black Girl, author of the new book, The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. When Barney Frank retired from politics in 2013, he'd spent over 30 years representing his Massachusetts district in Congress, and he'd also witnessed a dramatic social transformation that touched him personally.
Frank became the first member of Congress to voluntarily come out as gay in 1987. In 2012, he became the first to enter a same-sex marriage. That year, a poll in his district showed he was more popular for being married than for championing major financial reform legislation, the Dodd-Frank bill, the very thing that had made Frank question whether he could succeed in government at all in the 1960s. His sexuality was now more popular than his work as a politician.
Frank charts that transformation from a personal and political perspective in his new memoir, Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage. He joins us now. Representative Frank, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Well, you highlight a couple of major trends that you saw over your years in office. One strand of this is the public's opinion of government, and the other, the public's acceptance of the LGBT community. How have those perceptions changed during your career?
When I started, actually, I was 14 when I began to think about getting into politics. That was 1954, and it was very clear to me then that I had to choose between a public career and a personal life, because being a homosexual, as we then all called it, was something that was universally despised. I would note to Ben Carson with his incredibly stupid comment that sexual orientation is a choice, that as a teenager, I was not likely to choose to be one of the most despised people I could think of. So I thought, well, you know, I want to be in politics. There were things I want to do. I was appalled by the murder of Emmett Till, who was my age, 1954. I got some negative inspiration from a Wisconsinite, Senator Joseph McCarthy. I watched the Army McCarthy hearings. I saw his sneering and his bullying and the ability of other people to use the law to hold him in check. And I said, that's what I want to do. And I guess I'll just have to deny my own sexuality and not act on it because the two are incompatible. And as time went on, actually when I first ran for office, I kind of made a deal with myself. It was 1972. I ran for the state legislature. I was convinced I could not be elected if I was out publicly. At the same time, I said it would be just despicable to be a gay man and not be in support of other gay people. So I decided right away that I would unfortunately be a coward, but I would not be a hypocrite. And I became a very active advocate of gay rights from the very beginning. So what then happens is I see being gay or lesbian, bisexual, going up in the public esteem as we come out, as we defeat the prejudice. But for a variety of reasons, beginning in the 80s, government goes down. And so I kind of watch those two trends pass each other.
It's an interesting journey to have been on, and you were part of it yourself. You made history, in a sense, when you came out as gay in 1987. You were the first member of Congress to do so voluntarily. I guess a book was going to come out that was going to provide a clue about your sexuality. What was going through your mind then as you considered
taking this? Well,
actually,
the book had come out a year before. A guy named Robert Bauman, who was one of these gay hypocrites who was having a very active sex life with teenage young men and at the same time voting to condemn gay rights. And he wrote a book which hinted at it, but the press at the time was of the mindset that unless you were involved in some scandal, they would mention it. So that came and went. What went through my mind was that I did not want to live the way I was living, repressing my personal life. I tried to say, okay, I'll be a public figure and I'll be sort of neutral sexually, but in private I'll live as a gay man. But that doesn't work. The more prominent I became, the harder it was to maintain a decent social life as a closeted person. I've heard people say, well, you know, a good career can be a substitute for private life. That's nonsense. Most people have physical and emotional needs that have to be satisfied. And so by 1987, I thought it was likely that I could come out and survive it politically, but I also was so angry at myself for the repression I was imposing on myself and the irresponsible ways I was acting to cope with it, that I said, I'm coming out, and if it ruins my career, I'll regret that, but I've got to live. Fortunately, it worked out better. Of course, as you know, in Madison, I was the first to come out voluntarily. I was followed 11 years later by Tammy Baldwin, who was, very importantly, the first person to be out before she was elected, and that was another major breakthrough.
Right, you're not the first one anymore, but you were...
Well,
back
it was
then.
Different. I mean, I was the first to volunteer that I was gay once I had safely been elected. You know, Tammy did something that in many ways was tougher. She identified as a lesbian before the election.
Now, you've said that there are still closeted gays in Congress. Why do you think that?
Mostly because, there are two categories. There are a couple of older Democrats, I believe, and, you know, if you've been hiding from people all your life, and even at 47, I kind of encountered this, it just becomes hard to talk to people close to you and say, by the way, I haven't been honest with you. Generally, people know it. But that's only a couple of people, I think, maybe just one. On the Republican side, it's very clear. Those of us who've been out in Congress or in other political jobs as Democrats, like the new governor of Oregon, like Tammy, like six other members of the House right now, we are generally strongly supported by the Democrats. The Democratic Party has become the pro-LGBT equality party. The Republicans became the anti-party. And even though they're not as aggressive about it now because they know it's bad politics, the fact is that if you are a gay Republican, I say gay because there are not many lesbian Republicans at all. Lesbians have a double problem with the Republican Party as women and as gay people. But they're not very happy for you. In fact, in a couple of cases, very able gay Republicans were kind of forced out of office. I'll give you one example. By primary opponents, when Tom DeLay had to leave the House of Representatives, the candidate to succeed him, picked by the Speaker, Dennis Hastert, was David Dreyer, who was very able, very smart chairman of the Rules Committee, and he was named Majority Leader. And a number of the Republicans said, we can't have him, he's gay. He was widely thought to be a closeted gay man. And within a couple of hours, the Speaker withdrew his designation. Actually, the interesting point was that they said, oh, well, we withdrew him because he was too moderate. In fact, he was quite conservative, and I was asked at the time by the press corps in the lobby off the House floor if I agreed that David Dreyer had been removed from the leadership because he was too moderate. And I said yes, in the sense that after the moderate pride parade last summer, I went to a moderate bar.
Well, being gay is kind of a unique position to be in. If you're a woman, if you're an African American, you can't run for office as a white man and then come out once you're elected. So do you think that the gay people in politics have a kind of responsibility to other gay people to come out?
I think there's a strong argument for coming out. Look, and I maybe this is self-exculpatory. I think it's easier now. When I first ran in 72, I think I would have had to choose between being elected and not. In fact, I started by the late 70s. I was starting to come out. I was coming out on a retail basis to friends, getting ready to do it publicly. And then I got a chance to run for Congress, interestingly, I suppose, to people, because the Pope decided that the liberal Jesuit priest next door to me shouldn't be a congressman anymore. And when he told them he couldn't run, that gave me a chance to run. The priest, Father Drynan, who died just a couple of years ago, was a great anti-war liberal, did say that he was sorry he never got to see the Pope, who made him leave Congress to be replaced by me, because he wanted to ask the Pope if it had worked out exactly as he had planned. But I could not have been elected that way. I did come out about as soon as I thought I could. And the answer is this. Look, we didn't create the prejudice. No one is obligated morally to expose himself or herself to prejudice. I do say that it is morally despicable for anyone who is gay or lesbian to vote and support policies that are anti. And there have been a number of Republicans who have done that. And I believe that there's a right to privacy, but it does not translate into the right to be a hypocrite. beyond that, if you can come out, there obviously a value to it. And at least in my own case, I decided, look, if I got to choose between maintaining the kind of implicit dishonesty, I never said I was straight, but I was not being honest about being gay. If I had to choose, I was going to choose honesty.
So looking at some other areas of what you write about, you did tell the Daily Beast that the perception has been that liberal politicians have been too busy with women and gays and blacks to attract the votes of working-class white men. What do you mean by that?
I don't think that's accurate, by the way. I think that, as I reported to the reporter, that was the perception. Here's the deal, and I think we are frustrated, many of us on the liberal side, by the white men who vote for Scott Walker, who's trying to bust unions, who's trying to do things, unfortunately, sometimes succeeding, that are bad for them economically. White men who don't support efforts to make it easier to get higher education. You cut back on the University of Wisconsin, and white working-class people lose a chance to send their kids to a school that will give them that first-rate education and equip them better. And so I thought about why. There was, for a while, a view that, well, we're losing white guys because they don't like support Democrats for gay people or abortion, et cetera. I don't think that's true. We do have a problem with gun regulation, but mostly I think, look, the country's gone more and more pro-gay, and I don't think abortion has been a big electoral issue, even while white guys have been more and more alienated. And I think the point is this. Since the 70s, national and international economic trends have worked to the disadvantage of white men. Bill Clinton helped retard that disadvantage a little bit. But in general, the white men who in the 50s, 60s, and 70s could go to work on an auto plant or a steel plant and make a good living, that's gone away from them. And they are disappointed that the Democrats, who they correctly see as the party that's generally for government activism, hasn't supported them. Now, I believe they incorrectly think that's because we have been too worried about some of these other groups. I don't think that's a fact. As I said, that's the perception. The problem is that we're in a vicious cycle. A lot of white guys are angry at the government because it has not responded to their economic position. So they show that anger by voting for the people who are anti-government. And when the people who are anti-government take over, they then make it even harder for us to do the kind of things we'd like to do, like supporting unions or raising the minimum wage or increasing public construction, hire construction workers. So my proposals in the book are, and I believe this is the central point that I see it, if we could find the money to have the government do more for higher education across the board, to absorb more of people's educational costs, to do more infrastructure and put more construction people to work, to hire people at the city level to do a lot of those things that would be so welcome to people. If we had the money to do that, government would be popular again. The question is, how do you get that money when people wouldn't vote for anybody to raise taxes? So I have two very important proposals. First, I believe it is essential that we substantially reduce America's military budget. If we hadn't gone into that foolish and mistaken war in Iraq, we'd have $1 trillion that we could have spent over these years that could have helped reduce the deficit and also improve social programs. Secondly, it's time to stop locking people up because they use recreational drugs that other people don't approve of. If you're taking a substance that makes you likely to injure other people, we ought to regulate that, although it's probably too late to prohibit alcohol, which is the number one drug that makes people misbehave. But to lock people up because they use marijuana, to lock people up because they use cocaine. Using cocaine doesn't make you violent. What makes people violent is trying to get those things. If we could cut military spending to our legitimate military needs and stop locking up people for taking drugs, that would free up hundreds of billions of dollars at the state, local, and federal level, which we could then use to make this a fairer society, and as we did it, alleviate that anger on the part of white guys.
We're speaking right now with former U.S. Representative from Massachusetts, Barney Frank. His new memoir is called Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage.
And you can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for Barney Frank about his career or current politics? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation with former U.S. Representative from Massachusetts, Barney Frank. His new memoir is called Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage.
And you can join in. Do you have a question for Barney Frank about his career or the current state of politics in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Representative Frank, you've said that Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is by far the Republican's strongest potential candidate for 2016. What do you see at him? What do you see in him, I should say, that puts him at the top of the pack for you?
An absence of negatives. He is a very right-wing guy. He may not have started out that way, but he's carrying out a very right-wing agenda. This assault on unions in particular is very dangerous. It is not an accident that we have seen inequality increase and the position of working people deteriorate at the same time that the Republicans have been successful in attacking unions. And Walker does not look or come across as conservative as he is. I'm not worried about a Ted Cruz. A candidate who scares children isn't going to be the guy who's going to win. I think Walker has a kind of surface amiability. He's not the most impassioned speaker, but that works to his advantage in a general election. So, as I said, I think he is the very conservative guy who shows it the least, and that makes him the most dangerous.
And in terms of what Democrats would need to do to beat him, what would you say needs to be done?
Let people know what he really believes and what he really thinks. One of the real problems that working class and middle class people have is the inability of their children to get a decent education. What Walker is doing to this great institution, the University of Wisconsin, is a terrible thing. And people ought to understand what that would mean in terms of, look, there are two elements that we need to reduce inequality. Short term, to try and get some revenue into people. Longer term, to better prepare people to get the kind of jobs that will pay better. Attacking the university is a very serious interference with that. The right to work laws, which have only one purpose, which is to weaken unions. And I know it's interesting that they say, oh, well, right to work is really good for the workers. Well, then why do they want to exempt police officers? Are they mad at police officers? You know, that's an obvious hypocrisy. So I think we have to make clear exactly how conservative he is. And there are a couple of specifics. Obviously, I have an interest in the financial reform bill. It should be made very clear to people. That's popular. The Republicans are trying to undermine it, but they won't take it on head on because the people want financial reform. They understand how badly we suffered from total lack of regulation. We should be very clear that if the Republicans win the presidency in 2016, that's the end of financial reform. Even if they don't get majorities in both houses to repeal it, they will appoint the kind of deregulating regulators who will make it meaningless. So I that's a very important issue that will be between the two parties in 2016. Do you want to go back to a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that won't protect consumers? Do you want unregulated derivatives rocketing around the society and causing these crises? And there will be a cut in health care. And finally, very important, I think, for younger people, forget about any serious effort on the part of the American people if Scott Walker is president to deal with climate change. That is a disastrous policy to take. And so no financial regulation, no climate change, an assault on public education, anti-union. That makes up a pretty good package of things, I think, that people should object to. And finally, I assume he is in sync with his fellow Republican Paul Ryan, weakening Medicare. One of the great, Social Security and Medicare are the two greatest anti-poverty programs in American history.
And I want to go to a caller now. And we're talking a little bit about health care there in your answer. Let's go to Brad in Plover. Brad, hi.
Hi. Senator, you were against this strategy 5 years ago. But in hindsight, don't you think Obama and the Democrats would have gotten a better deal if they had started health care negotiations by first putting single payer on the table and then negotiating down from there? Instead, your side didn't even start negotiations with a public option.
All right, thank
you. Sir, you don't understand. I have to say, you don't understand negotiations. Yes, many of us were for a single payer. We didn't have the vote. People have a somewhat naive view of game theory in which the two sides have to negotiate. We did not have, look, most of us were for single payer on the Democratic side, but not enough. So, yes, many of us, we had a bill to do single payer. We were in favor of it. Many of us wanted to do a public option. Of course we discussed it. We just didn't have the votes. there's a kind of a mechanistic view of game theory that the more you start out with in your demands, the better off you'll be in the end. No, that's not true. Escalating your demands beyond what you have the votes for doesn't make the other people move because they know what you have the votes for. Let me put it on the other way. If the Republicans had started out by saying, let's abolish Medicare, would they have been able to hold us back more? No. So it is simply, as I said, an unrealistic view of game theory and of negotiation to think that if you start out with making demands that you don't have the votes for, you somehow intimidate the other side or influence them. I wish it were that easy, but it isn't.
Representative Frank, you retired from politics in 2013, which makes this interview now different than lots of the ones we do with other politicians, in that you can say whatever it is you like at this point. And in heading out on your current book tour now, is there anything that you've really wanted to say to the country, to people that you couldn't say while you were in office?
Pretty much no. I generally said what I wanted to say. I always felt a little unfairly treated by Fox News, or surprise, surprise, because they used to criticize me for being too blunt and outspoken and being, when people attacked me, attacking back. And then along came Chris Christie, and they thought that was wonderful. And at the time, under stress, I would tend to gain weight, and I thought they were guilty of maintaining a double standard for rude fat guys. It was okay if you were conservative, not if you're liberal. But there was one area that I did not want to discuss publicly, and that's my religiosity. I'm Jewish. Being Jewish is obviously both an ethnicity, membership in a communal group, and a religion.
And I'm sorry, we have to leave it there. I wish we had more time. Representative Frank, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Representative Barney Frank from Massachusetts. His new memoir is called Frank, A Life in Politics from the Great Society to Same-Sex Marriage.
Music fans, it's never too early to start getting ready for summer, the season of Summerfest, the largest music festival in the world, according to the Guinness Book of World Records.
And this year's lineup came out today, and it's looking pretty good. Robin, our compadre across the hall, one of Joy Cardine's producers, they're planning their summer listening already.
Now, here's some of the lineup. A Public Enemy is coming. Sheryl Crow, a Bastille, big with the kids these days, you know. DJ Paris Hilton.
Who somewhere along the way became a
DJ. Not sure how that happened, but okay, more power to her. Also, Whitesnake, one of your favorites from back in the day, Veronica. And I liked him, too. I had the cassette. And some bands who have been in a Central Time. Fox, Trampled by Turtles, Gaelic Storm, all playing, and Weird Al. So we'll go out with one of Weird Al's hits, his grammar-focused cover of Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines, the subject of a recent lawsuit. Here's Weird Al with Word Crimes.
Okay, now here's the deal. I'll try to educate you. Gonna familiarize you with the nomenclature. You learn the definitions of nouns and prepositions. Literacy's your mission.